I'm already a goner. Plus, the seven deadly sins read like a checklist of my adult afternoons. Any afternoon. On any day of any week, I could be driving my big truck with a boner for its bulk until I see a nicer truck with a cooler color than mine, which I forget about once the asshole driving it cuts me off. So I chase him down like a lunatic and give him the finger while challenging him to pull over and fight. 2 hours later, I'm taking a couch nap after torquing down an Italian footlong sub that I didn't offer any of to my wife, and 45 minutes after that, I'm awake and staring at this hot new Weather Channel chick who I think is predicting a hurricane, but I'm too busy staring at her tits to tell. Forgive me, which is a basic Christian belief, for not reading between the lines, but there ain't anything specifically against homosexuality on the deadly sins list. It also says nothing about cursing. So let's put a pin in that bullshit right now. A team of researchers from around the world recently finished a study proving people who use profanity are less likely to be associated with lying or deception and also score higher on IQ tests. Guess that explains why I'm a goddamn doctor of arts and fucking letters, bitch. And I'm not here to offend you. I'm trying to help. Instead of spending precious time covering your ears and writing letters drenched in religiously correct outrage about obscene words that endanger your pristine existence, listen to the facts. Jack Grieve, a lecturer in forensic linguistics at Aston University in England, decided to spend an entire year studying how we curse in America. Aston University is like Trump University, except for the fact that it has actual buildings with real classrooms where legitimate professors teach testable knowledge that leads to a legally recognized degree and educated skills that can get you a paid professional job. So, not the same at all, really. Because of America's vast cultural canvas and our guaranteed right to freedom of speech, plus our much-envied use of that freedom all day, every day, we were the perfect test group. Grieve and his crew created a unique data mining project using a massive corpus of geotagged tweets to measure and geocode lexical innovations and interactions along with stratas of even deeper digital information. As Professor Grieve said in a 2015 interview, it takes a while to count through all the data, but then you have a big index with the relative frequencies per billion words for the top 60,000 most common words in English, measured across the 3,000 counties in the contiguous United States, minus Alaska and Hawaii, and then run a local spatial autocorrelation analysis to help visualize the geographic clusters in the data. In other words, we curse like fucking crazy. God knows I curse enough to have a genuine interest in conducting a survey like this, but I've been a little busy working on Ice Age 6 with Jesus and his dad. Plus, I suck at science. I believe in it and love reading results, but if I were in charge of doing an entire year examining numbers and stats, it would only work if we were researching the Boston Red Sox or how many fucks there are in a Martin Scorsese movie. You can download a PDF of Dr. Jack Grieve's maps of the top 8 American swear words, which is included in this program. Dr. Grieve's maps prove that we all agree on one thing: cursing our cocks off. The top 8 swear words in America, according to the Dr. Grieve study, are number 1, fuck, number 2, bitch, number 3, shit, number 4, asshole, number 5, damn, number 6, fuckboy, number 7, cunt, and number 8, motherfucker. Now, fuck, bitch, shit, asshole, and damn cut across all voting categories, red states, blue states, north, south, east, and west. No matter how we vote on abortion and gun control, for or against, we all use the same swear words to express our opinions about the two issues. Fuck this shit, bitch. Not only that, we all clearly agree on hating the words cunt and motherfucker. But fuckboy, who saw that one coming? I'm proud of the fact that amidst all of our political, religious, and ethnic differences, we somehow creatively joined brains to add such a twisted new term to our national cuss word vocabulary. Sure, it's a surprise that bitch beat out shit in a close race for the second spot, and asshole barely defeating damn as they fought it out at number 4 is a shocker as well. Vegas odds and mine would have had damn finishing much higher. But fuckboy, a lot of us have been using it for ages, yet it's always been an occasional choice. I've been called fuckboy, and I've called my friends fuckboy, but the instances are few and far between when compared with something like buckface. Dr. Grieve even called fuckboy the fastest rising word on American Twitter. So it's a bipartisan pleasure to welcome fuckboy into the elevated bad language echelon that was once ruled by damn, which I would have expected to come in at least at number 3 given all its goddamn iterations. But as disappointing as damn turned out to be, the real motherfucker here is Motherfucker. I thought it was an easy top five favorite. It had everything going for it. Multiple syllables to trip off the tongue, significant sound elements for dramatic effect, and a long, successful career that raised the word above and beyond its literal meaning into usage as a noun, pronoun, adjective, and verb. But alas, it was far too little, much too late. When you finish in last place, behind cunt, that has to hurt. And speaking of cunt, I may have waited my entire life to type that last phrase. Why? Because I'm about to defend the curse word that came in seventh. First of all, the fact that it didn't finish last gives me hope. I love the word. Let me explain. I grew up surrounded by Irish people, so when the nuns told us we couldn't say the C word at school, we thought they meant cocksucker. For the Irish, cunt is akin to motherfucker in its sweeping and dexterous linguistic powers. Some examples. That car is a cunt. This cunty weather blows. He was cunting around down at the pub. To the Irish, cunt means everything except cunt. Fanny is the cunt of Ireland. Don't say it while visiting there. Ever. Don't talk about your fanny pack or mention Fannie Mae. Do not say, my fanny hurts, or you've got something stuck to your fanny. Which brings us to the issue at hand. Word power. George Carlin's famed seven dirty words were a list related to what you couldn't say on American television in the 1970s. Shit, piss, fuck, cunt, cocksucker, motherfucker, and tits. Now you can say them on cable TV whenever you want. All in a single episode, if you so wish. I just wrote a script that has all seven in one scene. But cunt still carries a stigma, even though it's just a word. Greaves' fuck map shows fuck surrounding the outer edges of America, stretching from the cold beaches of Maine on down the Atlantic seashore, throughout Florida and around the Gulf Coast, along the Mexican border and up the Pacific Coast Highway, all the way into Washington State, forming a curse curtain longer and stronger than any wall Trump could ever build. Meanwhile, cunt gets shunted into the cunt corridor of upstate New York and New England, with a dollop of use in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. We can assume most of these cunts occur while shoveling snow in 17 degrees below zero weather. Everywhere else in America is basically cunt-free. But looking at the maps, there is a cunt cluster located firmly on the Kentucky-Tennessee border. On the cunt map, it almost forms a tangerine-colored lipstick kiss. And if you look closely, you'll notice that the center of said kiss is the fabulous party-hardy town of Nashville, truly earning honors as the country music capital of the world. That's C-U-N-T-R-Y. I've been there a few times, and let me tell you, they say cunt so often in Nashville it makes me feel like I'm back in Dublin. Here's to Nashville for helping cunt beat motherfucker in the American swearing Olympics. But the rest of the United States has spoken, and libertards, conservadicks, and independent assholes alike made it clear they do not like either word. I think motherfucker is just having an off season or two and will eventually mount a comeback. But cunt has been stuck at the bottom of the standings since it was first invented. Cunt is the Cleveland Browns of cursing, a perennial pariah never allowed to rise up the rankings. Fear not, folks. Dr. Leary may have a solution. My favorite curse word of all time is one I first heard circa 1973. Goddamn cocksucking motherless fucking cunt. This was also weather-related. It was uttered by an Irish guy whose car wouldn't start in a Massachusetts nor'easter, and his blizzard of connected curse words pretty much summed up the situation. Years ago, on an episode of Rescue Me, Tommy Gavin's soon-to-be ex-wife Janet and current girlfriend Sheila sat in the firehouse kitchen texting insults at each other. Sheila mistypes her final attempt and it beeps into Janet's phone as cunf, C-U-N-F, one letter off, which is how we got it on TV at the time. But everyone on the set ended up liking the word so much that we started using it 24/7 in bars, restaurants, offices, any public place we shot in or hung out. It was a blast to see people on the verge of getting upset and outraged, but then holding back because they couldn't be sure whether or not they heard that final T. Now, substitute that one letter into the 1973 nor'easter, and it still sounds cool. Goddamn cocksucking motherless fucking cunt. See? It actually has a nice, soft ending that's a great change of pace from all the K's and C's. Besides, think how awesome it would sound on its own when you tell your boss, for Christ's sakes, Bob, stop being such a cunt. That welcoming F changes everything. It would bring cunt into the mainstream. It would become a staple in word games and crossword puzzles. For Scrabble alone, it'd be a boon. and that new soft sound would make it a hit under any circumstances. We stayed at the Kunf Hotel in Kunf, California. I had a Kunf cake for dessert. President Putin is acting far too Kunfy on this issue. Kunf could lead to a revival of dink, a word that fell out of favor once dick became popular. But as evidenced by the grief study, dick is no longer a top 10 terror. And as with Kunf, dink has the agility required for all access usage, the softer N allowing it into locations and conversations that the hard C keeps dick from ever entering. And just like Kunf, dink's power lies on the tongue of its speaker. The harder you say it, the bigger the hit. But it's not banned. So you could hear Mike Pence say this, China is being a real dink when it comes to diplomacy. To put it in some kind of linguistic equation, dink is to Kunf as prick is to bitch, a complementary curse coupling. And remember, they're all just words. Ever heard of bint, bellend, minge, spastic, or wanker? In Ireland and the UK you will, and they range from mildly offensive to outright insult. When someone calls you one of them, and they will, don't respond by using the word cuck. Much to the chagrin of many Trump supporters and cuckservatives, it ain't entering the common idiom. Cuck is not the new cunt. Cunf is. Call them that and confuse them. Like I said, I'm here to help. Now that we've discovered some common American ground and hopefully gained enough perspective to see how similar we all really are, let me move forward to help simplify things even further. Forget the seven heavenly virtues and the seven deadly sins. That's 14 things to keep track of as you go about your very busy day. And let's be honest here. None of us is capable of being that perfect all the time. I mean, even Jesus snapped at the temple merchants and knocked over their shit while berating their businesses. Right before he cured a bunch of lepers and made the blind see. But since most of us can't do magic, I'll offer the next best thing. A list. I'm combining the virtues with the sins and giving us a trusty little guide to cover them all. Here's how we handle it at hashtag shut the fuck up church. The new seven deadly sins plus one. Number one, racist, fuck you. Number two, sexist, suck balls, cause you sure ain't getting any pussy. Number three, misogynist, see above. That's right, you're guilty twice. Number four, lazy asshole, fuck charity, until re-binge watching all five seasons of Breaking Bad becomes a job, go get a real one. Five, drunk or high, liver transplants are for cancer patients. Six, selfish prick, die alone. Seven, fat slob, try some vanity instead of Taco Bell. Eight, stop blaming your parents. You still owe us money. You may have noticed that in both the 12 Commandments and the new seven deadly sins plus one, the only mention of killing was to enable you to defend yourself. I didn't list murder because we all know it's just unacceptable. Plus, it takes too much time. First, you have to plan it all in advance, coordinate your schedule with the victim's schedule, pick a place where there won't be any witnesses, and then map out approach and escape routes. But even if it's a sudden crime of passion, you still have to clean up afterwards, for hours on end. Walls and floors need to be wiped down and mopped up. Fingerprints have to be buffed off of doorknobs and kitchen utensils. Even if you wear gloves, you have to worry about fabric fibers and blood smudges. This is even before driving the body someplace to dispose of it, unless you plan on cutting it up, and that's a mess you'll be spending all fucking night on. Not to mention having to buy industrial-strength garbage bags, large gallons of disinfectant, and a selection of small power saws. And you'll probably have to do laundry, too, or find an incinerator, or burn your pants, shirt, and shoes in the woods somewhere, which involves even more driving and a change of clothes. No wonder they pay hitmen so much money. This is where good old-fashioned revenge comes in. Sure, it may take longer, but revenge is sweet and highly underrated. I have this thing that happens to me whenever I hate somebody. Their name disappears from my memory bank. This happened even when I was in my 30s and not worried about early-onset Alzheimer's or the faded edges of the aging process. If you fucked me over, my brain erased your name. I could remember your face, but I'd have to ask a friend or a coworker, hey, what the hell was the name of that guy we hated who used to be at HBO? But deep in the forested Irish recesses of my gray matter is a lush green clearing where I can always find my top five enemies of all time. Selfish, evil assholes I came across early in my life who screwed me and my friends over in so deliberate and criminal a fashion that I'm still waiting for each one to die a long, horrible, and early fucking death. I don't nurse my grudges. I juice them with steroids and keep them in cage-fighting shape. The late, great Carrie Fisher once said something I'll never forget. Revenge is like drinking poison and waiting for the other person to die. And that may be true. But in the case of these guys, it's not a daily venomous bile that restricts my ability to enjoy life. It's not even a weekly dose of noxious air that momentarily shuts down my operating system. It's just a latent desire to celebrate if the news arrives that one of them has been smote by karma. Or cancer, or a bus. Because that's what gets me in this God business. Karma. Too often in my life, I've seen great men and women wiped off the planet long before their time. Unselfish, truly talented, and caring people who looked out for others and loved their families and friends. Firefighters and film directors. School teachers and soldiers. Or just your average American living a life full of hard work and honest hours. The guys on my grudge list each spend their days stealing money from the sweat and elbow grease of others and show no remorse for their crimes. They attach themselves to the American way at an early age like a parasitic tick, just sucking up what they needed with no regard for anyone else. I know it's an ancient question, but when a great guy like my firefighter cousin Jerry Lucy gives his life in an empty warehouse blaze to save some homeless people, yet the selfish piece of shit junkie who started that fire still walks the streets, I gotta wonder where God is and what the fuck his master plan contains. And I know that sometimes evil, empty souls can suddenly see the light and turn their lives around, pull a 180 and start doing good instead of bad. This usually involves a medical scare. One guy on my list is a 58-year-old coke-headed asshole who's done nothing except mooch his way through the last 5 decades. Stole cash when he couldn't borrow it. Ripped off people who worked for him. Never a red cent spent on anyone else. Family hates him, never talks to his ex-wife or kids. Total waste. Then last year, he had a massive stroke. Lost the use of his left arm and the sight in one eye. He was in the hospital, clinging to life for a few days. And I'm not ashamed to admit that several friends of mine were hoping he wouldn't make it. As was I. Guess what? He did make it. And you know what he is now? A one-armed, half-blind, coke-headed asshole. So forgive me if I dance on his grave once it gets dug. I did figuratively dance on the graves of two other scumbags who I'm glad to say no longer suck anyone's blood or money. One guy woke up dead, which is a shame. I would have preferred some pain, maybe a stroke or two, at least an elongated heart attack where you had to fight for breath. Instead, he died in his sleep after ingesting 9 Oxycontins and a bottle of peppermint schnapps, which gives you some idea of how he spent his days on Earth, in a stupor. After dragging his aging parents through 6 rounds of rehab and countless arrests, not to mention a few 100,000 of their hard-earned dollars. When the call came in from a mutual friend, the only grieving we did was for his mom and dad, and even that was actually just a sad form of relief. This guy was such a nasty piece of work that even his current girlfriend refused to come to the funeral. Only 8 people showed up. One was his probation officer, probably to make sure it wasn't another scam. If I had my way, his tombstone would read, "Good riddance." During the phone call celebrating this fuckbucket's demise, 2 of my oldest friends brought up another cockwomble who hadn't come close to an early death yet. Matter of fact, he was walking through the new millennium healthy as a horse. No cancer, no liver failure, no arrest record, nothing. He was actually thriving. After years of running nightclubs and concert venues from which he robbed bands, comedians, waitstaff, and bouncers blind, after not paying taxes on barrels full of other people's cash, this jizz trumpet was living the life in a nice beach house full of bad vibes and high-end escort chicks. He'd learned how to beat the system, but the one trick he never picked up? How to swim drunk. They found his body the day after a late-night skinny dip, and man, did the phone calls fly. I'm talking multiple calls from musicians, comics, and other club owners celebrating this douche canoe's demise. A mere 8 months after the first asshole. Do I feel a twinge of guilt or some hint of remorse about getting such joy from another human being's misfortune? Let me put it this way. 2 down, 3 to go. Yeah, revenge is like drinking poison and waiting for the other person to die, but sometimes they die first. And take it from someone who knows, it feels fucking awesome. Maybe there is a God after all, and her name is Princess Leia. Fame changes a lot of things, but it can't change a light bulb. Gilda Radner. Social media disease. Last summer, Katy Perry streamed 96 pure, unfiltered hours of her life online, every inch, every ounce of her daily details and dilemmas. For four whole, uninterrupted days, you could watch Katy sleep, eat, cry, whine, curse, drink, and slather on makeup. And tell her shrink she's addicted to attention, which she got from an estimated 40 million sets of eyeballs, who sent out 96 hours of tweets, Snapchats, and Instagrams about it. This is what happens when you put smartphones into the hands of stupid fucking people. Scientists once believed that instant handheld access to all available information would make us more intelligent and aware of the world we live in, help us to open constructive conversation with all the other inhabitants of planet Earth. Globally, it has been a vital tool for fighting against injustice, hunger, and war crimes. So what are we Americans using it for? To chime in on Katy's beef with Taylor Swift about stolen backup dancers. And to send twit pics of our cupcakes, not to mention cocktails, pie, and pasta. If you follow me on social media, you may have noticed that I don't take pictures of my food. Why? Because I'm too busy fucking eating it. But I did chime in on Twitter about how we could end the Perry Swift war. Make them both listen to an Aretha Franklin song and suddenly realize, holy shit, we suck. Katy didn't take my advice, but she did take the time to extend this peace offering to Taylor. Quote, I think we can be like, you know, representatives of strong women that come together despite their differences, then like the whole world is going to go like, yeah, we can do this, unquote. If only Israel and Palestine were arguing about backup dancers, or ISIS hated us because of our choreography, then Katy 2020 could become a rallying cry. Hashtag kissed a Jew and liked it. Hashtag cherry Hebrew chapstick. By the way, during her promotional self-a-thon, Katy tweeted out pics, gifs, and memes of all her meals. This shit is becoming an irreversible virus. Even our new leader can't stop his tiny digits from tweeting about Trump Tower tacos and Kentucky Fried Chicken. Not to mention any instant idea that pops into his OCD head just as fast as he can type, which may explain his ridiculous, dumb, and unprecedented spelling mistakes. His Twitter feed is full of such unchecked English, along with reams of humble brags and arrogant blame placement. Can you imagine if past world leaders had access to this kind of technology? I did. When Trump visited the site of Lincoln's hallowed Gettysburg Address on a campaign stop, I listened to his speech and couldn't stop laughing. In the midst of a terrifying civil war rooted in the battle to abolish slavery, Lincoln had spoken of, quote, a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal, unquote. Trump's speech on the same sacred site was rightly nicknamed the Grievanceburg Address as he threatened civil lawsuits toward 11 women who had accused him of sexual assault. Lincoln's speech lasted 2 minutes. Trump's, 41 minutes and 55 seconds, after which he tweeted 6 times. On February 2nd, 2017, the National Archives and Record Administration announced that all of Trump's tweets would now need to be saved because the Presidential Records Act now reaches into the social media activity of any POTUS, including any deleted tweets, which means this all-time Trump favorite of mine will be saved there and here for posterity. This Trump tweet is from September 11th, 2013, and reads, I would like to extend my best wishes to all, even the haters and losers, on this special date, September 11th. Imagine if world leaders throughout history expressed themselves with such infantile, braggadocious abandon. Here are some choice social media moments from previous centuries, as delivered by noted figures if, like Trump, they just couldn't fight the urge to instantly express each inane thought tickling their itchy little brains. I call it 4 score and 7 seconds ago. And you can find the actual images of these tweets in the PDF that's included with this program. This tweet is from Thomas Jefferson. His Twitter handle is @ThirdPotus. His Twitter bio is writer, farmer, statesman. Virginia is for lovers. His tweet, what happens in the big house stays in the big house. Hashtag once you go slave. Sent at 3:45 a.m. on the 4th of June, 1803. This tweet is from Dolly Madison. Her Twitter handle, @4thFLOTUS. Twitter bio, you're looking swell, Dolly. Her tweet reads, James thinks it would be okay to sell my cakes and pies on the side. How about reading the Constitution, dipshit? Sent at 4:32 a.m., the 11th of February, 1813. This tweet is from Abraham Lincoln. His Twitter handle is @HonestPotus. His Twitter bio reads, 16th president, second marriage, guy on the five. His first tweet, failing @GettysburgGazette, forgot to publish last two-thirds of my address to the troops, plus song parody, hacks. Sent at 5:02 a.m., 22nd of November, 1863. This tweet is from Ulysses S. Grant. Twitter handle, @FuturePotus. Twitter bio, war hero, husband, not a fucking drunk. His tweet reads, Dear @RobertE. Lee, terms of surrender include changing your name to loser and sucking our dicks. See? #BringBourbon. Sent at 4:11 a.m., April 8th, 1865. Another tweet from Abraham Lincoln. @HonestPotus. Let me get this straight. I freed the slaves, but I can't get out of going to the theater. #KillMe. #GonnaHitTheStovePipe. Sent at 5:56 p.m., April 15th, 1865. This tweet is from Theodore Roosevelt. Twitter handle, @TeddyPotus. Twitter bio, rough rider, asthma sufferer, no smokers. Ladies, when I say I carry a big stick, it's not a euphemism, believe me. #MakeAmericaBullyAgain. Sent at 4:46 a.m., September 15th, 1901. This tweet is from George S. Patton. Twitter handle, @CowardKiller. Twitter bio, invented the tank and balls, which won us World War I. Excuse my French, but these fucking crouch chinks and wops will start another war, probably because they hate the goddamn kikes. Sent at 5:22 a.m., October 27th, 1918. Here's another tweet from Theodore Roosevelt, @TeddyPotus. He changed his Twitter bio to read, ex-prez, explorer. #HolyShit. Just drove through South Dakota, saw a mountain that looked like me. Got to cut back on the cough syrup. Sent at 6:34 a.m., August 18th, 1917. This tweet is from Adolf Hitler. Twitter handle, @TheRealFuhrer. Twitter bio, did I get enough hugs as a child? Who's to say? His tweet reads, got updated poll numbers from @JosephGoebbels PR. Approval rating 99%, not 97. #ToldYouSo. #GutenTagJuden. Sent at 4:05 a.m., March 7th, 1939. This tweet is from Eleanor Roosevelt. Twitter handle, @FirstBroad1. Twitter bio, behind every great man, a woman pushing the chair. Her tweet, FYI, the next guy who asks me if I need my husband's braces is going to need the red fucking cross. Sent at 5:23 a.m., February 17th, 1940. This tweet is from Eva Braun. Twitter handle, @MrsHitler? Twitter bio, former photographer, future bride. Her tweet reads, last time I blow @HermanGaring without getting the morphine up front. Sent at 4:55 a.m., March 15th, 1940. There's another tweet from Hitler. @TheRealFuhrer. He has a new Twitter bio. Killing it, and the Jewish race. His tweet reads, hey, @CharlesDeGaulle, can we get a late checkout, like the 12th of never? Way to put up a fight, #FrogFace. Sent at 4:13 a.m., May 10th, 1940. Here's another tweet from Eleanor Roosevelt, @FirstBroad1. She has a new Twitter bio. He talks the talk, I walk the walk. This tweet reads, look, he gets lap dances from @LucyMercer and I go carpet shopping, okay? It's called open marriage. Catch up. Sent at 6:02 a.m., June 4th, 1942. This is a tweet from Franklin Delano Roosevelt. His Twitter handle is @FDFuckingR. His Twitter bio reads, ended Great Depression, 1WW2. What did you do today, Gladys? His tweet reads, fourth term, motherfuckers. Packing the SCOTUS with cripples. #BenevolentDictator. #ChairForce. Sent at 5:01 a.m., March 5th, 1945. Another tweet from Eva Braun. Her new Twitter handle is @MrsHitler. Her new Twitter bio reads, winner of 1945 Berlin Bridal Gown Award. Her tweet reads, Anyone know if it's okay to take cyanide capsules on an empty stomach? Sent at 6:37 a.m., April 29th, 1945. This is a tweet from Harry S. Truman. His Twitter handle is Give Him Hell, POTUS. His Twitter bio reads, Proud Missourian, Best Boy. This tweet reads, Hey, at Tojo, funny, you don't look Enola Gay. Soup of the day, hashtag Mushroom Cloud. Sent at 4:38 a.m., August 6th, 1945. This tweet is from Dwight D. Eisenhower. His Twitter handle is, at 5-star POTUS. His Twitter bio reads, Brilliant military tactician, shitty putter, honorary bald eagle. This tweet reads, Dear at General Douglas MacArthur, you still mad, bro? Sent at 6:01 a.m., January 21st, 1953. This tweet is from Pat Nixon. Her Twitter handle is, at Mrs. Dick. That's M-I-S-S-E-S. Her Twitter bio reads, Cloth Coat Club, not an accomplice. This tweet reads, Having trouble with at White House phones. When I'm talking to Trisha, it sounds like there's someone else on the line, eating. Sent at 7:24 a.m., February 8th, 1973. This tweet is from Golda Meir. Her Twitter handle is, at Solid Golda. Her Twitter bio reads, Prime Minister, Stateswoman, former hand model. This tweet reads, If at Moshe Dayan says to me, Hey Jake, when's your next fight one more time? No shit, the other eye goes. Sent at 4:17 a.m., July 28th, 1973. Another tweet from Pat Nixon. At Mrs. Dick. Her new Twitter bio reads, Former First Lady, current bitter spouse. This tweet reads, Just found out wife can't testify against husband. Bad. Sent at 5:47 a.m., 31st of August, 1974. This tweet is from Betty Ford. Her Twitter handle is, at Jerry's bitch. Her Twitter bio reads, Disco doesn't suck, Jimmy Carter does. This tweet reads, So he keeps falling down, but I have to go to rehab? Hashtag double fucking standard. Sent at 4:25 a.m., November 14th, 1975. This tweet is from Margaret Trudeau. Her Twitter handle is, at Wake Up Maggie. Her Twitter bio reads, Estranged First Lady of Canada, Studio 54 VIP. Her tweet is, Difference between the Mihaljevic brothers? When Frank goes down on you, he takes his teeth out. Sent at 3:35 p.m., May 28, 1976. This tweet is from Idi Amin. His Twitter handle is, at Hallelujah Amin. His Twitter bio reads, Ugandan strongman, recovering genocider, polygamist, Pisces. This tweet reads, New Year's resolution, start eating healthier, only gluten-free people. Sent at 4:43 a.m., January 1st, 1977. Another tweet from Betty Ford. At Jerry's bitch. She has a new Twitter bio. It reads, Rosalind Carter is a cunt. This tweet says, That was not a typo in At Good Housekeeping. My rice pudding recipe calls for 7 bottles of vanilla extract. Hashtag lick me. Sent at 6:39 a.m., December 25th, 1977. This tweet is from Nancy Reagan. Her Twitter handle is at Mommy1. Her Twitter bio reads, Playing the role of Jane Wyman forever. This tweet reads, Blue entire AIDS budget for 1985. Just say no to astrologers who think they can play the horses. Sent at 3:57 a.m., October 21st, 1985. This tweet is from George H.W. Bush. His Twitter handle is, at Read My Lips. His Twitter bio reads, 40th and 41st POTUS. Oh, like I didn't run the country after Reagan got shot. The tweet reads, Me and at Jeb Bush still laughing about George Jr. saying he's gonna be prez one day. Hashtag oldest child syndrome. Hashtag lay off the snow. Sent at 11:37 p.m., January 27th, 1989. This tweet is from Saddam Hussein. Twitter handle, at Husseiniac. Twitter bio, tortured soul and 200,000 dissidents. This tweet reads, Sunday at the palace, 12 to 2 p.m., first annual mustard gas cook-off. First prize, oil field in Fallujah. Second, oil field in Kuwait. Sent at 4:10 a.m., July 14th, 1990. If only. What a trip they all would have been on Twitter. Each one is now forever famous for great achievements or eternally infamous for failed events and ideas. But the key part of the formula usually is this. Most presidents and world leaders gain their biggest audience after they begin their public bid for power. The campaign trail is the fame highway that transforms them into a household name. Not the Donald. Trump had 30 million followers before he even thought of running for the Oval Office. Because he was already a celebrity. And these days, it seems everyone in America wants to be associated with one. Or become a celebrity themselves. As a matter of fact, many were more likely to follow Trump on Twitter than to actually vote for him. Out of the 240 million Americans eligible to vote in the last election, over 100 million never even bothered to show up. They could care less about politics. One poll showed that more of us were concerned about losing belly fat than what Trump or Hillary might do to the country. It's been this way for decades now, but in the last 8 years, such apathy has reached supersonic levels, to the point of parody. One day in February 2016, 439,102 people voted in Kim Kardashian's Twitter poll, asking fans to name her husband Kanye West's new album. That same day, only 135,077 people voted in the GOP presidential caucus. I guess it makes sense. And could be another form of thinning the herd. Do we really want reality TV fans voting for president? Too late. They already did. One pre-2016 election poll showed that most Americans knew Trump as a television host, not as an actual businessman. They loved his brash behavior and cold-hearted, "you're fired" catchphrase. And his hair. They loved staring at his hair. It currently has 5 Twitter accounts, and there are another 4 dedicated only to his hands. This is our future, folks, where shucking your shame, blame, face, and body on a daily, digital, or weekly televised basis is now a career option. Forget the me generation. This is me, 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 24/7, 365. Like me on this, love me on that. My hair, my face, my media, my memes. And our taste runs to social media accounts belonging to self-involved celebs. The top 5 Twitter feeds in the world? At Katy Perry, with 96 million. At Justin Bieber, 93 million. At Barack Obama, 89 million. At Taylor Swift 13, 84 million. At Rihanna, 70 million. At YouTube came in a distant 6th. I'd say it's the only actual entity on the list, but every single person in the top 5 is an entity, operating on a higher plane than the rest of us. Not just a celebrity, but celebrated and elevated. The only world leader in that group is President Obama, who has tweeted 15,000 times in 10 years, mostly about hope and change and why it still might happen. Sounds like a lot until you find out our current president has tweeted over 35,000 times in 8 years, an average of 14 times a day. And always about himself, which is what Katy Perry does, and Bieber, and Swift, and Rihanna, and every other major pop star. But they ain't occupying the Oval Office, although they might as well be. Because people flock to these feeds like it's a life force that can save a hungry human soul. Not famous themselves, but somehow adjacent to fame, as if that will eventually gain them a touch of notoriety as well. People stand outside the glass windows of every New York City morning show studio, waving like fools and using selfie sticks to immortalize their time as human stick figures on deep background TV. Then send the pics soaring out into the anonymous social media stratosphere, hoping to get some kind of hits that say, "I see you, wish I were you, cute jeans," but mostly come back as, "fuck you, fat ass, dumb cunt." So they spend another few hours feuding back and forth in 140 characters or less. I don't do Twitter feuds. I prefer a good old-fashioned face-to-face "fuck you." If you don't want Twitter trolls making comments about how fat your ass is, here's a very simple solution. Stop posting pictures of it. Besides, most of these idiots cutting you down have 7,000 tweets and 6 followers. Heads up, halfwits. Jesus was a pariah in his own time, and he had 12. By the way, you want to know how you stop a cyberbully? Pay attention now, because the answer is a little complicated. Ready? Here it is. Turn off your fucking phone. Read something other than your own social media apps. Buy a fucking book, and for God's sake, stop taking selfies every 15 seconds. 24 billion selfies were uploaded to Google Photos last year. 21 billion of them with some form of face-slimming filter. That's supposed to be a joke, but instead sounds like a real possibility, doesn't it? The amount of time spent photographing ourselves and then altering the image is astounding and sometimes fatal. There are now actual stats on selfie-related deaths called killfies, when people die while trying visual stunts to gain some social media magnificence. In 2014, 15 people died this way. In 2015, it was 39. Last year, 73 people met the Grim Reaper while pointing their phones at their faces in dangerous places, and this year's number is predicted to finish somewhere north of 150. So far, in 2017, two teens taking a selfie on the tarmac were killed by a landing airplane. A kid seeking a bigger Snapchat audience had his girlfriend film him as he parkoured onto a third-floor mall railing. Only problem? He missed and fell to his mushy death. One college released a statement concerning the death of a student who was live-streaming himself as he tried to chug 10 Mai Tais in less than 2 minutes. It might as well have read, "This was a test." You heard that, right? Tragic? Yeah. Stupid? Fuck yeah. But hey, these addle-pated idiots are doing humanity a favor. They are thinning the herd for us. Here's the official list based on a recent university-sponsored data study. Frequency of selfie-related deaths from 2010 to 2017. Number 1, falling from great heights while posing. Number 2, falling from great heights into the ocean while posing. Number 3, posing on, near, or in front of trains. Number 4, drowning while posing, parentheses, boats, logs, surfboards, unparentheses. 5, accidental shooting while posing with a gun. 6, hit by truck, bus, or car while posing. 7, poisonous bite while posing with a rattlesnake. 8, bison. 9, grenades. 10, juggling, as in fire, knives, chainsaws, and chainsaws on fire. Are we really going to miss any of these asinine dopes? No. We shouldn't be warning them. We should be encouraging them. If you're enough of a fatuous pinhead to have your death make this list, you deserve to disappear. Posing with a rattlesnake? Sorry, that's not just a grave error. That's a way to find and eliminate jackasses. And as bad as the first 7 are, the last 3 don't even mention posing on, near, or with the cause of death, which implies what? Taunting a bison? Tossing a grenade? Again, if this is how some lummox plans to get famous, don't stop him, okay? Instead, hand that goon a grenade. They want to fuck with a bison? Let's open a bison amusement park and make some cash off these clods. Better yet, let's combine it all together. I'm sure there is some chump out there who wants to ride a bison while juggling grenades and his cell phone live on Snapchat. What I wouldn't give to see that motherfucker die. And therein lies the real problem with all of this. It's not the dullards who hatch these dense ideas. It's us, the audience who watches their stupefying torpidity. The dumber they are, the more superior we feel. Each one of these oafs wanted to go viral, and you can bet your left nut that, had they survived, their injury-inducing selfies would have sucked in an almost endless supply of put-downs and negative posts. Nothing brings out the insults and online abuse more than a bunch of mutton-headed Darwin Award winners who are self-chlorinating the gene pool. We can only look good by comparison. As we say in Boston, it makes us feel wicked smart. That's why we all love reality TV. The more puerile and scummy the dolts on these shows get, the more self-esteem we accumulate by watching them. And my, how the ratings rise. Each week, our eyes and ears get assaulted by the overheated mewling of supposed real housewives whose only desire is to be so outrageously memorable that they can tie their tawdry names to clothing, booze, and food products. I never set out to watch these shows. But having walked in on countless friends and family members doing so during the first season of Real Housewives of New York City, I couldn't figure out why. Until I gazed at a few minutes of it. Holy shit. The fighting and the feuding, the insults and alcohol flying back and forth, the narrow-minded emotional minutiae and flat-out egotistical fury of it all. Half an hour in, I felt like a saint. Like motherfucking Teresa. Like I was such a good person, I should be nominated for a Nobel Prize. And the biggest surprise of all was Bethany Frankel. Bethany used to work for me as the set chef on Rescue Me. She was funny and fast and an amazing cook. Seeing her on The Real Housewives was like doing a fame double take. She wasn't only the brightest person in the cast, she was suddenly a bigger star than I'll ever be. I was pretty much done with it after a couple of viewings, but that's when I came to realize there was no escape. Like all of us, I've had the horror of seeing the endless promos packed with their latest season-ending, shriek-filled, ear-bleeding tirades, and felt their Botoxed eyeballs and trout-pout lips leaping out at me from a zillion magazine displays. We can't escape their vacant stares or overinflated balloon tits. Or the millions of other needy fuckwads constantly clawing their way up the ladder of public performance. It's a nonstop cry for attention by people who are famous for doing nothing other than exposing their surgically altered asses all over every available electronic device you own. YouTube talents and Instagram stars. Facebook virtuosos and Snapchat VIPs, who would all kill to get on reality TV, where the crowded field is already packed with ego-deranged fools, singers, actors, and ex-athletes, girlfriends, husbands, wives, and ex-wives, real estate brokers and construction workers, people who hunt, pawn, pour, paint, drive, fix, and fish for a living, all aiming to become household names, to join what they see as the rich and rarefied celebrity class, where their actions, quotes, and looks can be paid for and adored. Every single one of them dying to be famous in their worst way, which is usually how they end up achieving it. Because no one thinks about the consequences, where once you make a name for yourself, each and every embarrassing drunken foible or drug-induced mistake is covered as breaking news on Twitter and TMZ. Let's put the chase for fame into some form of reasonable perspective. The next time you think you're one in a million, placed on this crowded earth because your outstanding talent, unique looks, and incredibly witty remarks deserve to be noticed and publicly acknowledged, and that somehow luck or divine intervention will lead you to the golden corridors of Hollywood's promised land, take a beat. Then visit a site called InternetLiveStats.com. I did so at 7:36 a.m. on March 31st, 2017, and here's what was happening. Current users of Internet, 3,600,883,045. Current tweets sent today, 207,149,787. Current Instagram photos posted today, 21,209,631. Current blog posts written today, 1,522,608. Current Facebook active users, 1,878,623,995. There are 430,000 tweets per minute in America, 500 million tweets every 24 hours, all day, every day, an endless ocean of anonymity, reminding us all we ain't nothing special. Nanosecond after millisecond, fake faces and real food and snarky remarks and their angry ranting replies, tits, pecs, postures and posteriors fly into and out of our cell phones, singeing the retinas with vapid information. Everybody screaming to be seen and heard. I've been a celebrity for exactly 25 years now. Seen it from every angle. Clacking up to the tippity top and then speeding straight down the insane fame roller coaster. The rush of it all sucking the air from your lungs. And the whole 1,000 mile per hour rocket ship trip done without any breaks. Hair blown back, stomach in your throat, best laid plans flying out of your hands and fluttering away in the wind. The term overnight sensation isn't technically true. It takes quite a while to happen. But once your recognition starts to pop, it does feel like you wake up one morning and your world has been altered. Suddenly, everyone knows who you are. People stare and point and shout your name. And everyone wants a piece of you. And to many old friends, as well as many new friends, you become a human dollar sign. I'm not complaining. Fame and success brought wealth and security for my wife and kids and many members of our extended family. And you do find out who your real friends are, or should I say were, very, very quickly. If you're a comedian, old friends from your club days suddenly accuse you of stealing ideas or subjects, as if Lenny Bruce, Richard Pryor, George Carlin, and Joan Rivers hadn't already covered every topic known to stand-up. But once you make it big, these old pals can turn into newfound enemies. As they gander at you on Conan or Fallon, they see ghosts of their own jokes in every word you utter. The funnier and more famous you get, the more furious and ridiculous the charges. I once had a close comedy compadre accuse me of stealing one of his hand gestures. I repeat, a hand gesture. said he saw me make it during an appearance on Letterman, which he watched 3 times, once in slow motion. He also thought Letterman stole one of his jokes. That's how deeply fame can infect the non-famous. A rock and roll lead singer pal of mine was accused of stealing a stage pose by a far less successful singer who saw him strike it on Jimmy Kimmel. This guy claimed he'd invented the pose. When my pal said he saw David Bowie do the same move back in the early 90s, the accuser said, "Yeah, but I made it better." In the recording business, famous bands are often hit with allegations of lifting a riff, looting a look, or adopting a vibe, always by bands that never made it. A famous actor pal of mine once got rave reviews for his Richard III and then faced allegations of theft from one of his old acting school classmates, who said my pal had stolen his cadence. It seems when this guy saw my friend's performance, all he could hear was his own voice, which was not a famous one. In all three branches of showbiz, former friends who don't make it as far will curse your fame with a series of bitter salvos aimed at everyone except themselves, or claim the only difference between your success and their failure is this: you just got lucky. And luck is a part of it all. Luck matters. Ask any famous person, and they'll have a comment or two on the role happenstance played in their careers. Here are some great quotes on the subject from some very noteworthy people. "Success is simply a matter of luck. Just ask any failure." Earl Wilson. "When it comes to luck, you make your own." Bruce Springsteen. "The harder I work, the luckier I get." Sam Goldwyn. "I do believe in luck. How else can I explain the success of all the fucking assholes I hate?" My friend Fitzy. Okay. Fitzy's not famous, but he does sum up how a lot of jealous people approach the accomplishments of others. It's easier for them to justify their own misfortune by pointing at your success and saying you don't deserve it. Behind every famous athlete, comic, actor, singer, writer, and politician you are aware of, there are 15 people you've never heard about saying, "That should have been me. Shoulda, woulda, coulda." Each famous person I've ever gotten to know tells a tale of ex-friends lost on the trail of bitter showbiz tears. They can't see the mountain for your trees. How many humans actually have the balls to look in the mirror and blame themselves for failing to make it? Answer: not enough. Trump never points the finger at himself for either his very public business fuck-ups as a private citizen or his even more public mistakes and blunders as president. Love him or hate him, he did win the election, and Hillary's probably still blaming Bill for that. Bernie's busy blaming both of them and Donna Brazile. As JFK once said, victory has 1,000 fathers, and defeat is an orphan. Nobody wants to shoulder the blame for their own demise. Few and far between are those public figures willing to stand up and take the beating when things don't go the way they planned, or even accept the facts when it comes to their own lack of ability. Whitey Herzog was a Hall of Fame baseball manager known for speaking his mind. After taking the reins of the last place Texas Rangers in the fall of 1972, he told reporters, "If Rich Billings is our starting catcher again next year, this club is in deep trouble." To which Billings later replied, "He's obviously seen me play." Wouldn't it be nice if more famous people had the same sense of humor and honesty when it came to facing their limitations? I'll give you just one glaring example of when mine came into undeniable focus. Watching The Amazing Spider-Man in 3D. I knew my nose was big. I'm not a moron. I've lived with the thing for 6 fucking decades. But it's one thing to see it in a mirror and a whole different nightmare to see it on the big screen wearing 3D glasses with 1,000 people watching. My kids wanted to attend the splashy LA premiere of the movie. They begged and pleaded, so off we went. Now this may sound strange, but if I'm not producing or directing something I'm in, I don't watch it the way you do. When I'm involved in the process of editing and mixing, I can be objective about my own performance and judge it purely as part of the overall story. But if I'm just acting in a movie, watching it fills me with remorse about other creative choices I could have made, what I could have done better. I'm not looking at myself in terms of appearance, I'm looking at the character. But seeing Captain Stacy's nose in 3-dimensional display, 4 stories high, that nose didn't belong to him. It was all mine. The thing was massive. You could have parked 4 school buses inside each nostril. And the school. About 4 seconds after I first showed up on the giant screen, I tore off the 3D glasses. 30 seconds later, I was out in the lobby having a smoke and making an early entrance to the after party with what now felt like a much smaller snout. A little bit of humility can be very useful out on the public stage, and hard work. That's the real difference between being a flash in the pan or a perennial presence. Today's headlines are yesterday's news. There are boatloads of gifted people on this planet, no matter what field you wish to compete in. But are you willing to make the sacrifice and put in the effort it takes to excel? Hall of Fame hoop star Larry Bird took 300 practice shots before every single game he ever played. 50-plus years into their career, the Rolling Stones still rehearse for a minimum of 4 weeks before heading out on each tour. Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Robert Caro's first book about LBJ took 6 years to research and write. The second one took 8 years. The third, 12. Lady Gaga burst onto the music scene like a lightning rod in 2008, only 22 years old at the time. Her first two singles shot through pop culture. Many critics considered her a two-hit wonder. After she wore a dress made of raw meat to the 2010 MTV Music Video Awards, several of them wrote her off as an attention-seeking gimmick machine. 7 years later, they're still wrong. And it's not because she continues to show up on the red carpet wearing a see-through plastic bubble and boots made out of dwarves. It's because she spends countless hours writing and creating original music and puts on a 3-hour live show full of acrobatic dance moves and furious vocal maneuvers without one single note of lip syncing. She's the real fucking deal. And of course, she's been accused by musician friends from the old days and various no-name bands of stealing ideas, riffs, her persona, and, believe it or not, even the meat dress. Every time you see someone like Gaga blowing the lid off an award show with an amazing performance, there's bound to be a bitter bunch of unknown artists she started out with tossing back beers and bemoaning her existence. Instead of getting on with their own careers, or switching careers because they just don't have what it takes to make it. Like Gaga once said, she was famous before we knew who she was, celebrating her own private celebrity, a star in her own life, walking the same walk, talking the same talk, without money or a trail of paparazzi. For some people, being famous in their own lives should not only be enough, it's probably even better. I have a friend who was a star hockey player in high school and thought he'd end up playing in the National Hockey League. He was by far the best center in the state where he was raised, a natural scoring machine. Not much of a defensive player, but hey, when you're putting the puck in the net 2 times a game, nobody complains about your back checking. He didn't have to try harder. He was born better and got drafted in the first round. The second best player from his school didn't get drafted at all. He was too small, too slow, and not a natural scorer. Within 3 years, my buddy was out of the game, blaming his coaches and the shitty minor league teams he played on for ruining his career. His excuses? They never gave him a chance to shine, didn't know how to get him the puck, wouldn't let him play his game, blah, blah-bitty, blah. So he moved back home and became a firefighter. A great firefighter, highly decorated, respected and trusted by his crew. The second best player? He was a walk-on at an NHL camp, made the cut, worked his ass off in the minors, listened to the coaching staff when they taught him new techniques, became an all-around player who hustled his balls off and never complained. His professional career lasted for 10 years. My buddy never stopped grumbling about that. Every time we saw the second best player skating in a big tilt on TV or in an article in the paper about his hustle and grit, my friend would rant and rave about how much better he could have been if he'd only been able to do it all his way. "I got fucking screwed," became his mantra. Until one night, when he was bitching about his nemesis so much that a fellow firefighter finally said, "Dude, there are 3 people walking around this city tonight because you personally saved their lives during a fire last year. Not to mention about 6 other people you saved during the last 2 decades. Fuck hockey. You were born to do this job. You didn't get screwed. You got pointed in the right direction." And that was the moment my buddy gave up the ghost. From that simple statement on, he's been a satisfied guy. In a perfect world, he would be famous for running into burning buildings when everyone else is running out. The celebrity spotlight ain't for everyone. People think it's a magic wand that will solve all their problems financially and emotionally. Having been exposed to the hot white light of Hollywood for 2.5 decades, I can tell you this. Fame isn't a cure for anything. Matter of fact, fame is the disease, and it's eating our country alive. A few years back, the Wagner Group conducted their first ever poll to determine the 100 most trusted people in America. Deep research on multiple levels, testing several different layers of confidence, reliability, and faith in public figures. Here's the top 10.